Okay, well, thanks to the organizers for having me here. I'm happy to present this work to a crowd of people that I don't have regularly contact with, so I'm quite excited by the feedback I'm going to get. So maybe I can start with my name. It's very much of a problem. And but if you have ever drank wine, and wine from Bordeaux, maybe you remember that my name is has just the same ending. So my name is Dumont. And speaking of wine, I have one first slide that sort of introduces why I study plants, and they keep us fed and healthy and happy. I don't know why half of my slide is here. But. And I think there are two major questions that are becoming more and more severe. One is that the population on the Earth is increasing, and people sort of predict that we should manage to increase our yields by about 70% over the next 40 years. And that's going to be quite tough, because at the same time, the planet is challenged by global warming. This means that in the areas that are most productive in agriculture, yield is going to decrease, and species are going to be, crops are going to be increasingly exposed to drought. Okay, so those are sort of the major questions, societal questions that plant science has to address. And I'm not sure that genetics is the best way to address that. There's a lot of societal questions in the first place. But if we can understand what makes plants increase their yield and what makes plants resist to different types of stresses, environmental stresses, we might be in a much better situation to address those problems in the upcoming years. Okay, so this is very practical, and I'm not that practical. I'm interested in sort of very, very general questions, and one of them is to understand what is the reason why lineages die or survive, and whether we can understand or disentangle random effects from selective effects in that. And I have a bunch of different plant species just to show that they're beautiful, and but I work on that one that's not very, very impressive, but has the advantage that it grows in, over almost the whole globe, and can grow in very, very different environments.
So comment about 85 lineages about Darwin's figure, or about your?
Yeah, past? that's the figure of Darwin.
Okay, no, sorry, yeah. I was curious about
no,
that.
No, it's just because people kept asking me.
Okay.
So one day I counted. One of the questions I'm interested in is, what are the molecular changes that are important for adaptation? And so I have here two different types of sketches that people often use to represent evolution. One is a fitness landscape, where you would have fitness increasing and a population moving up a peak. And the other one is the idea of drift, with several mutations that arise and disappear and sometimes get fixed by random drift. And I have in big red these lines, because I'm exactly interested in what are these mutations? What are they doing? What's the biology behind that? Most of these sketches are sort of, they don't care about what genes and what functions, and I think it would be really interesting to know that, because as we heard already last week, the type of trajectory we can have, and it depends on the shape of the fitness landscape. And so if we can understand that fitness landscape, or predict even how it's going to be, we're in a better shape. So what type of approaches do we have to elucidate adaptation at the molecular level? And I think over the last years, there was a number of single gene approaches where people have tried to relate phenotype to genotypes into fitness and try to understand how a novel molecular change got fixed in a population. The tools we have are molecular genetics, ecological genetics, population genetics, phylogeography, evolutionary genomics, all these things. And in the end, what we have to do is, I mean, I represented here as something very linear, but it's probably much less linear than that. It's probably much more something that looks like a labyrinth, because we don't really know how molecular phenotypes relate to phenotypes of ecological importance and to fitness. And if the molecular function is usually quite well conserved and can be predicted from alignments, the function in its ecological context is a lot more difficult to predict and probably evolves a lot faster than the molecular functions. Okay, so I have worked on these different aspects, and recently we've moved towards asking a little bit different questions, and we were interested in understanding whether we can see the whole of the mutations that are important for adaptation. So here it's a sort of sketch of mutation spectrum, mutation effects. And we know a number of examples of mutations that have large effects on fitness. They've been elucidated at the molecular level. Usually, they've been fixed because they have an important effect on the phenotype itself. But for mutations, a very small effect, we don't know very much. Nevertheless, they might be important for adaptation. So if we put it like this, those mutations that have been identified usually with QTL analysis, sweeps and genome scans and things. But for these mutations, they usually are the ones we don't see. We know nevertheless that they're important. So small effect mutations do matter, and I have here three examples from over the last years. One is this analysis of fitness variation in Arabidopsis thaliana that was run, published by Fournier-Level et al. In Science in 2011, where people have identified a number of SNPs that are associated with fitness and with differential fitness in different areas. And this is the centroid distribution of these alleles that provide increased fitness. And you can see that the distribution is skewed towards the place where they are most adaptive. So the red one are the ones that were adaptive in Valencia, and you see that the distribution is relatively more to the south compared to the ones that were adaptive to in Finland. So this was a sort of genome-wide signature of local adaptation on SNPs across the genome. Because there were so many mutations that were adapted, one can simply hypothesize that each of them has individually a very small effect on fitness. So it's the joint or the accumulation of all these mutations that allow local adaptation. This is another type of studies that people do now in agricultural science and crop sciences, where they try to use SNPs over the whole genome to predict complex phenotypes. So they initially, people tried to use QTLs to do that, and they managed to predict phenotypes very poorly. And now that they have the ability to include all SNPs throughout the genome, they have a much, much better prediction. And this is this correlation here. This is the observed yield, and this is the predicted yield. And you see that predicting yield from the whole collection of SNPs throughout the genome is much more performant. And then there are studies like this where people run genome scans, and it's basically this. Lots of SNPs throughout the genomes that individually contribute to increased fitness. So the conclusion of this is that we now have very strong evidence from genomic studies that alleles of very small effect add up for adaptation. Okay, and then the question is to try to understand what might they be doing at the molecular level, what is their biological function.
Can I ask you a quick and naive question?
Yes, please.
When you say the large number of SNPs associated with fitness, are you talking about increased fitness above the average or decreased?
Yeah,
so be much less interesting.
No. Well, here it's a genome scan for signatures of selective sweeps.
Okay.
There's different approaches. Here is
okay.
Selective sweeps scan. Here it's simply a linear model using all the SNPs throughout the genome to predict it. And here it's actually also genome scan, it's GWAS, it's association with fitness,
okay.
In multiple locations. Okay, and so because I'm talking a very small effect, I have a picture of Fisher's ghost here. So Fisher was quite important in sort of finding out that adaptation could proceed with very small mutations, and so that you could have very smooth evolution, but directed evolution. The thing is, Fisher used actually sort of statistical models to do that. And so each of these genes were sort of statistical units that had no materialistic essence. And so he was not really interested in the biology that was underpinning it. But I think that now we can try to address this based on a similar way of thinking. And so this is the phylogeny I work with. So I work with three species in the Arabidopsis genus: Thaliana, Halleri, and Lorata. Halleri and Lorata are sister species. Thaliana is a little bit of agroup to these two. So Thaliana is the most worldwide distributed from the south to the north of Europe, and it's also colonizing the US now. Lorata is growing in Central Europe and in Scandinavia as well, and there are some populations that are set up in the US, in the Americas. And Halleri is quite interesting because it has a very specific ability to tolerate and accumulate heavy metals. So it has a little bit the specific ecological niche. And so the question that I'm going to talk about today is, what do infinitesimal mutation do in this genus? Can I find them? Can I map them? Can I make the difference between the ones that evolved along this part of the lineage, along this branch, or along this branch? And can I find different evolution in different molecular system in this genus?
Sorry, can you add
infinitesimal? Infinitesimal, it's just too small to be mapped in a QTL.
It has to be a single mutation?
It has to be a single mutation. So the idea is that when they add up, they do something big. But individually, there will be impossible to track at the molecular level in the lab. And so the cost of that is that we have to shift from this ideal of tracking the mutation, the adaptive mutation, to try to understand the collective properties of these mutations. That's a little bit of the cost. Okay. So after this brief introduction, I have a little bit of my outline. So I'm going to talk about how I'm trying to track the signature of polygenic selection. Then I'm going to talk about the results of what we've been doing, the biological interpretation that we think we have. And I hope I will still have time for perspectives. And so I'd be glad if you could tell me like 10 minutes before the end so that I can directly jump to the end. Okay, so this is the iceberg, and this is what we see, and this is what we don't see, and this is what I want to see. So we have this phylogeny, Thaliana, Halleri, and Larossa, and ideally, if I can differentiate the mutation that arose before separation between the two species and after separation between the two sister species, then I might be able to identify the processes that have led to the accumulation of these mutations. So let's see. If there is no selection, I expect that these mutations should be... Sorry. This is a sort of something that we've constructed. It represents what I call the functional landscape. So each of these things is probably a gene, and if they're close together, it's probably because they control the same phenotype. Okay, it's just a sketch.
Is it sort of a cartoon or some...
It's just to put colors on it. So if there's no selection, I expect that these mutations will be randomly distributed throughout the functional landscape. Okay, they should not accumulate in a specific group of genes that together form a specific phenotype. Okay? Now, if there is strong selection that is acting constantly on the phenotype and that the response to selection is provided by small effect mutations, then I should find this phenotype to be changing. And if it's changing, it's because there's a number of mutations that allow it to change, and it should accumulate there. So it should look like this. Like, for example, we would have here a series of genes that are important for some sort of phenotype, and they have accumulated a large number of mutations. And here, for example, that would be in the Larossa lineage, here in the Halleri lineage. Okay? So if
we... Are you going to explain, like, how the clustering of the modules is...
Yeah, I'm going to explain that. Yeah. For the moment, it's just what I call a functional landscape, but... The only idea that I want to convey with this is that the genes that are just close together are underpinning the same phenotype, okay? So if you want to modify that phenotype, you're going to have to tune lots of genes there, okay? So we are in a situation here where that is sort of similar to what people do with DNDS ratios or relative rate tests. We are trying to see whether the distribution of mutations in different lineages is statistically similar or contrasted. And if it's contrasted, then we think that one good explanation for this contrast should be natural selection.
So, yes. On this cartoon, these circles don't have names on them, but could, say, pick out a circle in the bottom here and call it 13. Could 13 be in some other cluster as well?
Well, if it is, I'm going to be in trouble too for the biological interpretation.
Exactly.
Yes. But yes, it can. I mean, the genes do what they have to do. I'm going to show you how I deal with this.
Okay.
But yeah, so.
With one interruption, you said in the bottom, it says cis regulatory mutations.
I'm going to.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I should have removed that not to frustrate you. But I'm going to show you afterwards. It's the next slide.
Okay.
It's really which mutations we can use to do that. But to go back to your answer, to your question, I mean, what is very important is if we understand the biological landscape quite well, we'll be more performant in interpreting the data afterwards. this is clear. I'll come back to that. So yeah, so I'm talking about cis regulatory mutations. So the question is, which mutations would be more suitable to do that? And so people use SNPs, but SNPs, you know, you don't know what they're doing. Half of them are probably synonymous. If they're not synonymous, they probably don't do much. And so what we need are small effect mutations. We need to have many so that we have statistical power. They need to do something. Well, so that we can analyze their collective properties and that their collective properties are meaningful, they should have a small effect on fitness so that they can accumulate. And because we do experiments, this should be very easy to type. And we have a good candidate for that. Those are cis regulatory mutations. And I'm going to show you what these cis regulatory mutations are. So if you have a gene that is transcribed, the transcription of this gene is controlled by a number of cis acting elements directly upstream of the gene, and interacting with transacting factors. We have an advantage in plants is that there's no very distant enhancers, so we can simply define cis-acting as anything that is encoded at the locus, okay? What's the advantage of these mutations? Well, they have a significant molecular phenotype because they can change expression. They're active, because we can see, if we can see a gene being expressed, we can see that they're active. But they can also be environment responsive. And that's quite interesting because we can then use specific environment to trigger, to analyze responses to environments that are of ecological importance. Right? They occur frequently, and we've worked on this before. So throughout the genomes, you can find thousands of them. Most of small effect on fitness, there's so many of them. There might be some that have large effects.
But how do you know, I mean, if you test them one by one, then you probably know. But if they appear, there are many of them, then maybe one actually has a large effect on fitness, and the other ones are passengers.
Yeah.
So how do you know that each of them has sort of equal effect on fitness rather than, as I said, driver-passenger relation?
I don't directly consider that. So if they are a passenger, they should not enrich the same molecular system, the same functions, right? They should be hitting a different function. Can we get back to that question in a few slides? Because I hope I'll clarify that.
So, in response to the answer you just gave a few minutes ago, I thought you said that your definition of small was that they didn't have any phenotype on their own individually.
I was saying that the effect on the phenotype is too small to be tracked in the lab.
Okay. You just said that you have.
I can type them, but then if I want to use this to see how much it changes the phenotype, uh-huh. It's going to be really hard, because probably it just changes the phenotype by a few percent, and I will need such large populations to show that it would probably never work.
So how did you assign the clusters?
The clusters.
Yeah, it has an immeasurable effect. How do you know which cluster?
Okay, so I think I'm going to clarify this right in a few minutes. I'm going to show you how I do the enrichments first, and then because the clusters is not what I do. I'm taking the information that's in the databases.
I'm not going to let you do.
Yeah.
One more question: is there some practical reason why you have to ignore, say, non-synonymous mutations or mutations within the transcription unit?
So one of the reasons is that I don't know whether they're active and whether they do anything.
But you don't know that for these ones either, unless there's something that you need some more stuff.
I know that they change the expression of the gene. And I'm going to show you why, because actually
a measurable phenotype, though.
I have a measurable phenotype, but it's a molecular phenotype. Sorry, I'm talking about real phenotypes, like fitness, yield, growth rates, things like that.
Okay.
But yes, they have a molecular phenotype that I can measure, because if I couldn't, I couldn't infer them. I'm going to show. So what is very nice with cis regulatory mutation is that there's a trick to identify them very simply in a single transcriptomic experiment. And I'm going to show why that is the case. So if you have two lines and you look at a specific gene, say this one, and you look at its expression level, the expression level of this gene between the two lines will just depend on the activity of the promoter or the cis-acting activity and on the transcription factors, okay? So I do know that this gene is expressed differently between these two lines, but I don't know what is the genetics of it, okay? It could be just changes in the transacting factor or changes in the cisacting region. So what I want to have is a collection of mutations. So I need to know the genetics of the changes in expression that I see. And I can do that if I bring these two genomes together in one individual. So when I do a hybrid, I have the two genomes in the same cell. They're exposed to the same mixture of transcription factors. And so if the two cisacting regions have the same activity, I should find equal numbers of the two alleles, okay? But if I find different numbers of alleles, then this means that there is a difference at the cisacting level, okay? And because now with transcriptomic, I can do that throughout the whole genome, I can assess throughout the genome how many genes have an allelic ratio that is different from 50-50. And because it's a transcriptome, I can expose the plants to different types of environments and try to see in which environment do I have allelic ratios that are different from 50-50 and at which genes. Okay, so that's how I get a genome-wide populations of cisacting mutations that are active in a specific environment.
But I still don't get the logic of why they have to be just in the upstream regulatory region.
Well, I don't know really, because what I measure is allelic abundance. So right. It could be RNA stability, it could be...
Right, so those SNPs could be in the transcription unit, not in the control unit.
They could be in the transcription unit.
But yeah.
I don't really know where the SNP is. I consider if I have an allelic ratio that's different from 50-50, it's at this locus.
Okay.
But I don't really know what is the
So it's really, you're looking for linked EQTLs.
Yeah, for cisacting QTLs.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
I think this splitting into cis-transit, you're assuming there's no cis-trans interaction, I think, right?
There might be, but for a cis-trans interaction to happen, you need a cis change. So yes, there might be.
Right.
So
you need a trans change, too. So.
To express it. Yeah, well, I ignore that. I just count where the mutations are at this point.
So the logic is sort of, in a sense, inverse, right? First you detect deviation from 50-50 rule, right? And then you go and see what's responsible for that, right? Which
I don't
deviations?
Really see what is responsible, but I just have, for the whole genome,
yeah,
a collection of genes that show this ratio difference.
Right, but then...
And then afterwards I try to see where they are functionally distributed and whether they accumulate in specific functional units.
Okay. But you don't go after individual mutations to identify what might be responsible.
I mean, I could, but...
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that was the method. And so we're applying it to our Arabidopsis system. So we'll hear again the phylogeny.
Sure. Yeah. I just want to make sure I understand. So you're not setting out to specifically ask questions about these particular classes of mutations. You're setting out to ask a broad question about the effects of these very small mutations, and this is the experimental system you've set up to do that.
That's what I use to have a collection of mutations. I know there are mutations throughout the genome that change this expression. That's all I'm using. And afterwards, I want to run a statistical approach to try to understand where that might be happening. Okay. So the Arabidopsis genus is interesting because species have very different ecologies. I mentioned this earlier. So Thaliana has a broad species range. It's a pioneer species. It is an annual species that grows very fast. And Lorata and Halari, which is sister species. Halari is heavy metal tolerant and hyperaccumulator. So this allows it to thrive in soils that are contaminated with heavy metal, but not only. It's also thought to be a way to defend against pathogen and possibly against herbivores as well. So it's probably a new type of defense that this lineage has evolved. Lorata has a much more robust way of growing. It's cold and dry tolerant. I'm putting a question mark because we're trying to expand a little bit the evidence of and quantify exactly how dry tolerant it is. But we know in our hands, we've been growing it for about 10 years in the greenhouse, it's much more tolerant to our low water availability than the other species. It also grows in environments that are much less competitive than Halari. So the question we're asking is which molecular system were involved in adaptive divergence between those species. So I've introduced to you the F1 strategy I use to have a collection of mutations. And the next step that's important to understand is that we can also do this in a way that we can define what is derived in each lineage. And that's what I'm going to show now. So here is a Y phylogeny, Salyana halorai lorata. And what I have is I can do hybrids between species. So with these hybrids, those hybrids are sterile, but the plants are doing quite well. And I use these hybrids as a tool to map throughout the genomes which genes have a change in allelic expression. So I have two types of hybrids, between Thaliana and Halorai and between Thaliana and Rasa. And then I can say, if I find a change in expression and in a different, an allelic ratio that's different from 50-50 in both hybrids, this means that it must have evolved before the two species have diverged. Whereas when I have a change that I see in only one hybrid, I can interpret it as derived in the corresponding lineage. So that would look like this. I can, by seeing which mutations do I find in both hybrids, define what is ancestral. What I find in this hybrid will be defined as evolved in the Halorai lineage, and what I find in this hybrid evolved in the Lorata lineage. Okay? That's a simplification of the phylogeny of what I see. I'm going to show you that it's probably quite accurate. The data I'm going to talk about is for these two hybrids. Each time we took one parent as representative for each species. We have done RNA-seq on plants that were grown under control conditions or exposed to 4 degrees for 1 hour, so as a to monitor the response to cold stress, and dehydrated at room temperature for 1 hour. We have 3 replicates paired in read sequencing and quite a few reads. So that takes me to the second part of my talk, what signature we found and whether we can infer that polygenic selection has been at work in the genus.
It's the 1 hour temperature treatment, it seems fairly short. Do you know how long that changes gene expression for an individual?
Yeah, so it changes about, if I remember correctly, about 2,000 genes. From the something like 16,000 that we can analyze in all 3 species.
And after you end the temperature shock, do you know how much time elapses before the genes go back to the pattern of expression seen before?
No, I don't know this very well, no.
Also, just to understand the difference between these two subspecies, how similar, what's the degree of difference between those two relative to the range within Arabidopsis? You said that
So they are 2 to 5 million years separated, Halorai and Lorata, and these two are separated by about another 5 to 10 million years from Thaliana.
So the range of sequence versions within
Between Thaliana and Lorata, it's 15% at synonymous sites.
I guess, but maybe I'm trying to, are these two species more similar to each other than, say, two very divergent Arabidopsis guys are?
No, they are sister species. They're the closest in the genus. Yeah. Okay, so what we use to map to quantify allelic ratio are SNPs that differentiate, that allow us to infer what is the parental allele, okay? What is the parent of origin of each allele? And we quantify this throughout the genome. Here is for the Lorata-Thaliana hybrid, and what you see is that most of the ratio centers around zero, I mean the log ratio, and this is because we have a very good reference genome for Thaliana and a very good reference genome for Lorata. Halorai is a sister species, but we didn't have such a good genome of Halorai. And that's how the ratio initially looked like. It was a catastrophe. So basically we had, So we had a deficit of Halorai alleles that mapped, basically. So we had to work on that. So what we did was to chop the reads into smaller bits and then remap them. And that's how it looked after this, and already the ratio was a lot improved. And then we realized that there was regions of high SNP density that were where it was really tough to quantify correctly the both alleles. And we removed those from our calculation of allelic ratios, and we ended up with a distribution like this that was centered very close to zero, with still a little deficit of Halloray allele we detected, but something that was more acceptable. Okay, so that's just to show how we've been trying to deal with this. And the next thing is when we looked at the different samples, we clustered them, and when we looked at expression levels, so the number of fragments per millions of reads, for millions of bases, what we could see is that these samples clustered in the first place by the different treatments that we imposed. Okay, standard condition, cold, or dehydration. And when we did the same thing, so this means that the plasticity is probably the same in the two hybrids, or it's very comparable, okay? Because the reaction to the environment is the same for the two hybrids. This is or more related than the environment response, right? And then the other thing we did was to look at how it clustered when we looked at allelic ratios, and here you can see very strongly the effect of the genetics. The allelic ratio clearly clustered by hybrids. Okay, so it's the genetic differences in those allelic ratios that we see here. So this means that the cis regulation differs between hybrids, and it's going to be interesting to look at the distribution of these cis acting changes. Okay.
So you can reconstruct that tree from that plot?
That tree from that plot? Yeah.
Cool. Using some threshold for once it gets beyond this.
No, this is just a hierarchical clustering based on the correlation between allelic ratio in the samples.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not really, it's a heat map. Okay. We used a different method to validate what we found. This is the correlation we have when we correlated our RNA-seq measurement with paro-sequencing measurement. So very good correlation. We can validate the ratios we find with a different method.
So what does each data point mean here?
So it's one gene and one environment and one replicate.
But I thought there are many genes here. So you focused on some small number of genes
here,
right?
Yeah. This is just taking a few genes and try to see whether we find the same. Yeah. So I'm going to show you we have another thing. So the other thing we did was to see whether our data overlap with data we had published with a completely different platform that was a SNP array that we had been using. And yeah, this is going to take us back to the glass of wine, right? It's half full and half empty. So what you see here is the log ratio that we get in RNA-seq for the genes that we quantified for allele, where we quantify the allelic ratio using SNP arrays. In red is the genes for which we found an allelic differences with the SNP array, and in black is the genes for which we find no allelic differences with the SNP array. So you see that for the genes that for which we had no allelic differences in the SNP array, with RNA-seq, we don't find that neither. And for the genes where we find an allelic ratio difference with the SNP array, we have these little bumps here that show us that we also, for a number of them, we also detected with the RNA-seq. Okay, but for a number of them, we don't. It's different genotypes, it's slightly different conditions as well, and it's a completely different platform, and I trust a lot more the SNP, the RNA-seq platform than the SNP array. The SNP array is you put your things on the array, and it's a black box. You can't really dig into it, and when I see how much work we had to really make sure that we assign correctly our allelic origin, I think it's quite all right. Okay. The other thing we did is for one of the environments, we replicated the experiment entirely. So in standard condition, the Salian-Alirata hybrids, so this is a second, so the first and the second trial, each 3 or 2, 4 replicates, and this is the correlation we get in allelic ratio. We recover about 75%, so 75% of the genes that have an allelic ratio in one trial also have it in the other trial, okay? So again, half full, half empty, but quite all right. We have just to keep this in mind that there will be noise in the data we're going to analyze. Okay, so now we can run the phylogenetic analysis of the cis regulatory divergence. This is a volcano plot. This is sort of the raw data. So here we have the ratio for Halloray-Salyana hybrid, and here for Lorata-Thalena hybrid, the allelic ratio. Here we have the p-value corrected for false discovery rates. In red, the ones that are significant. So the genes that show an allelic ratio that's different from a log ratio that's different from zero in both hybrids will be assigned to be ancestral, which also means derived in Thalena. And the ones that have an allelic ratio that's different from zero in only one hybrid, in only this hybrid, is assigned to be derived in Halerai, and in only this hybrid is assigned to be derived in Lorata. So here it's another way to represent it. Okay, does it make sense to classify genes like that? And
I'm a little confused.
Yeah.
I mean, suppose things just happen randomly. Isn't there a 50% chance you'll just converge to the same expression of both species?
It is possible. So when we started the experiment, we didn't really know how fast the cis regulatory, how often you would have mutations changing the cis regulation. And then it could go up and down. If we had this happening a lot, we would have a different plot here. So this is the log ratio in the Lorata hybrid against the log ratio in the Halerai hybrid for the three different conditions that we looked at. In gray, it's when it's not significant, and when it has a color, it's significant. So what we have here in yellow are the ones that show an allelic ratio different from zero in both hybrids along this diagonal. Okay, so in yellow, those are the ancestral changes that predate the separation between the species. In blue are the ones that have a change only in one type of hybrid, in the Halerai hybrid, and this is only in the Lorata hybrid. And so if this happened a lot, to have mutations that go in one direction and the other, I think we would find a lot more points in those two parts of the plot. And we find very few of them. So I think overall we have an acceptable phylogenetic signal when we look at the overlap between the two hybrids. So that is my argument against that. Okay, so now we're back to the question that I introduced at the beginning. Are cis regulatory mutations enriched in specific molecular system? And can we get something that looks like that? So here again, it's also technically a little bit difficult because we have to look at, first of all, what is the landscape, the functional landscape we're going to use? And here I'm only going to show data by GO categories, so classifying genes by GO categories. And then when we look for specific enrichment of these different types of mutations, the derived one and the ancestral one, we have to think of what is the universe we're going to use, and we have to think about how we handle the data. Do we look at things that are expressed in one stress or the other, things that overlap, things that are specific to one stress but not seen in the other one? And then the other question that arises is, what is the p-value cutoff that one should use? And so we've been sort of trying all sorts of things for quite some time. And in the end, what I think is the analysis we've decided to focus on is one where we don't have to put a p-value cutoff on the differences. We try to rank them by the differences in allelic ratios. And then we looked at enrichment among ranked genes, which then... So allele-specific expression. It just means that the ratio is different from zero. Yeah, sorry about that. And so if we rank them, we have actually sort of a continuous distribution. This is a little bit the idea behind the ranking. So here we rank all the genes in the genome that have, they're ranked by the difference in log ratio between the two hybrids. Okay? So here in other genes that have, so here for each gene you have in blue the ratio in the Halerai-Thalena hybrid, and in red the ratio in the Lorata-Thalena hybrid. And what you see here, the genes that rank first are the ones that have a very strong, very high ratio in Halerai, in the Halerai hybrid, and a ratio close to zero in the Lorata hybrid. Okay? So this is what we expect as being the signal we get if the change is derived in the Halerai branch, the Halerai lineage. On the other side, we have the ones that are derived in the Lurotan lineage. What we did is we ranked all the genes for which we had evidence that there was at least one environment where there was a change in allele-specific expression, an ASC difference. That is that we looked at enrichment among genes that can change their expression. And here on top is the overlap that we have between the ranking and the correspondence or the coincidence between the ranking we had and the overlaps that we had between when we called significance for the different allelic ratios. So here you see that we have most of the genes that are have an ASC ratio that is specific to, that is significant in the Halerai Thaliana hybrid and absent in the other hybrid, they rank really correctly, right? Okay. There's another thing we did is we decided also to focus only on allele-specific expression differences that would increase expression in the derived lineage. And that was because we anticipated that if we looked at things that are down-regulated, this could be due to relaxed selection. There's a number of pseudogenes, and so we didn't want to be too much confused by that. So we focus on all the genes that show an increase in expression, thinking that the increase in expression is more likely to be important for something. And then what we ask is among the genes that have an increased allelic ratio, which functions are enriched? Okay, so here my animation doesn't work the way I wanted it. So this is again the ratio, this time removing all the ones that don't increase the expression in the Halerai lineage. And what we run is this so-called KS test from Ackermann and Strömer, which is basically trying to look in the ranking for a given category, whether most of the genes are up in the ranking or just randomly distributed throughout the ranking, okay? And for the ones that are enriched, then we have most of the genes that accumulate at the top of the ranking. So the advantage of that is that we don't have to set a threshold on the differences between the ratios. What we did, though, is we wanted to have a p-value cutoff here for the enrichment that would be above random enrichments. So what we did is we ran we randomized the rankings and looked for what was the frequency with which we got significant Go categories that were enriched. And so by using a cutoff of 0.009, we could control the false discovery rate below 10%. Okay. And so, well, this is how it looks like in the end. We have a list of Go categories that are enriched among Halerai-derived genes or Lurata-derived ASC genes. These Go categories correspond to biological processes or molecular functions, and they are enriched in different, in either standard called dehydration or more than one. Okay, and they have associated p-values, so they are all below 0.009, which was our threshold for keeping the FDR rate below 10%. So with this rate, we had about 32 enriched Go categories. So, okay, so now we had our Go categories that were enriched. I'm going to talk a little bit about how I interpret them at some point, but we thought it's nice to have this list, but maybe we find Go categories that don't have exactly the same name, but that are quite related, and maybe they are actually distributed in similar molecular systems, and that would tell us actually if functions that evolve fast just because they don't have strong constraints. And so what we wanted to know is what is the distribution of these enriched functions in the functional landscape. And so what we did is we took these Go categories and we computed their semantic distance to try to construct a cluster of how related they were. And this is how it looks like when we looked at all the significant categories. And in red, we have the categories that are enriched in Lurasa. In blue, the ones that are enriched in Halerai. And what you can see is that they are distributed in different parts of the tree. So it's not that we have similar functions that are enriched in the two lineages. Okay, it's clearly different functions. Okay, so this is based only on the on the enriched Go functions, the ones that are significantly enriched. And we also wanted to look with respect to all the genes that are expressed. Do we see Also, the enriched functions are in completely different part of the landscape.
So is the tree like saying which Go categories have overlaps?
Yeah, it's hierarchical clustering actually based on on each Go categories we have an index of similarity based on how far they are on the Go graph. Sort of, yeah, engineered for our needs a little bit. And so this is again a cluster this time for all the expressed genes. So for all the Go categories for which we have a gene that is expressed. And you see, again, in red, the functions that are enriched in Lurata, and in blue, the ones that are enriched in Halorai, and you see that they are clearly separated. And so what I think this is, so the way we interpret this is to say that if they were drift, we would have no enrichment. If it were relaxed constraints, we would have similar systems that would be highlighted or closely related systems. And so since we don't have that, when enticing explanation is that it's probably a response to selection that happened via the accumulation of many changes to small effects. So what molecular system did that hit? And so this takes me to the third part, the biological interpretation. So the first thing that we saw is that among the functions we have, we had lots of functions that were related to metal homeostasis and metal transport. Specifically derived in the Halorai lineage. So transition metal ion homeostasis, cation homeostasis. And these categories include many genes that are known to be important for metal homeostasis in this species. So they have been investigated. People have found that their transcription was different between Halorai and Thaliana, and they have good evidence that those genes are important for metal accumulation, at least in Arabidopsis thaliana. This is a sketch of some system of zinc accumulation, so how people understand the cellular accumulation of zinc in Arabidopsis halorai. There are transporters that bring the zinc inside the cytoplasm, inside the vacuole or outside, and pump it out. And we find HMA4, we find MTP1 and other members of the same family. We find different genes. So lots of these genes were among the genes that all had increased cis activity. Okay? For HMA4, people have identified the promoter changes that were important for the cis actin change. So here we were quite happy to find that because this is sort of our proof of concept, right? We expected to see heavy metal as being one function that is really specific to that lineage, and we find the genes and we find the functions that are related to this very specific function. So what did we find in Lurata? In Lurata we found fewer Go categories that were enriched, but among them we find that fatty acid metabolism was strongly enriched in standard conditions. And here was this picture. You can see this is a leaf of Lurata, this is a leaf of Thaliana, and you see that these leaves are a lot more waxy, and this is why they are much more resistant to drought. They can retain water much better. And so among the genes that we find that category, there's acyl carrier proteins, acyl ATP thioesterases, and several KCS genes that are important for wax synthesis. Okay?
These are all nuclear genes.
Yes. So the second category seems to have quite some good support in the literature that really the genes that we find here have an effect on wax, and we know from the phenotype of these species that Lurata has a much thicker wax layer on the leaf surface. Another category we find is the chlorophyll biosynthesis pathway. Actually, it's one of the derivative of fatty acid metabolism, and one of the first functions that is just below our threshold is actually chlorophyll biosynthesis. So we find actually these genes are being significant in another class. And this is the pathway for chlorophyll synthesis. And what you have to understand with chlorophyll synthesis is that it's a very tricky pathway because there are intermediates that are very toxic, phototoxic. And those are the free protochlorophyllic components. They are free, and they can create lots of oxidative damage. And for this reason, the pathway is very tightly controlled, and there's a very strong feedback. And the feedback is mediated by this protein, FLU, that interacts with this enzyme and this enzyme as well. And we found that there are cis-actin changes here, here, and here, in specifically derived in Lhasa. That seems to sort of show a convergent evolution of different elements that are important for that pathway. And then there are other genes like this gene, G6PD3, that is strongly upregulated specifically in the Lhasa lineage. And this is a gene that's important for detoxifying reactive oxygen species and oxidative molecules. And the other thing that we find that suggests also that the oxidative stress is reduced in Lhasa is that one of the chlorophyll binding proteins has a lower cis activation, and then maybe this is speculation now, maybe that has to do with the fact that Lhasa is much better at dealing with oxidative stress. Okay, and we know this.
Could you just say again how you got from all the allelic specific expression data to these functional categories?
Well, it's actually the GO category that is enriched, and the gene ontology category. Okay, and so there's a number of genes that belong to this category, biosynthesis of chlorophyll, and we find it enriched among the genes that have a Lhasa derived change. And here I'm just listing some of the ones that have the strongest changes, and they hit genes for which there is support in the literature that those are genes that directly interact to control the pathway. So based on that, a good hypothesis or a follow-up experiment would be to try to look at how chlorophyll biosynthesis is regulated in Lhasa and try to see whether it's different from thalliana. But we know from our experience in our hands, Halorai, if, you know, sometimes maybe, well, when you grow plants and you grow them in the greenhouse, sometimes in the summer the temperature goes up to 40 and everybody's dying, and this one is actually surviving extremely well. So it can be very strongly stressed, and then it just revives very well. So it seems to have a very good way to deal with oxidative stress, whereas Halorai, if it gets stressed, it's sort of kicked out of its balance and then it doesn't recover. Okay. Another function we find, and that's specifically in plants that are dehydrating, we find that the acylglycerol biosynthesis process was enriched. And we try to think of what could that mean. So here is the bilayer of the membrane. And in the face of stress, you have ROS emission, which tends to saturate the lipids and makes the membrane much more rigid. And to counteract this effect, fatty acid desaturase can be overexpressed. And that people have done that with transgenics and shown that if you do that, then you have better resistance to stresses. And so what we think is that maybe this functional category has to do with how the biosynthesis of lipids and the maintenance of the membrane integrity in the face of stress. And this is something we can now start to analyze in the lab, try to see, okay, what is the composition of lipids in thalliana, Halorai, and Lhasa, and how does it change in the face of dehydration stress? Okay. So this is just a summary of the different functions we had. And so I think I can come to the conclusion for that part.
Can the Halorai and Lhasa be hybridized?
Yes.
But you have done that?
I have done that as well, but it's not included in that analysis. Yeah.
But you'd expect the
directions to be replicated. Yeah. So the fact that we find that enrichment in vastly different functions, and that we find enrichment in the first place and that they hit different functions, is suggesting that selection might be shaping this pattern. The fact that we find cis-regulatory mutations enriched among heavy metal genes that are important for heavy metal tolerance provides us with our proof of principle that this thing can detect, this approach can detect molecular systems that are really of specific ecological importance. In Lorata, we can now start experiments to try to understand what's the effect of fatty acid biosynthesis and the stress response. And then I would like to go a little bit onto the problems we can have. And you mentioned already, I mean, the problem we need to understand, if we have a good understanding of the functional landscape, we'll be more performant. And the interpretation of GO enrichments is definitely very limited, and it's not always optimized for plant physiology. One example is for proline metabolism. So we don't find proline metabolism among the GO categories that are enriched. But if we basically, if we take a list of genes that people have set up for which they know if you change them, there is a change in the proline accumulation pattern. Maybe I should mention that proline is an amino acid, but it accumulates in the plant cell in response to cold or dry stress. And it is an osmoprotectant for the plant cell.
Can I ask you about the GO coverage? How many of the genes you found are actually annotated by GO? So how many are not annotated? How many do you throw out of your analysis?
I don't really know the numbers.
Is it a good coverage or 50%?
I would have to check because, well, it's good enough that we can do the enrichment.
Yeah, sure, sure. No, but
it's, just it, but it's never good enough for it. So we removed everything that was only computational, but there were some annotations that was integrative computational, so based on genomics data and large scale data sets and so, which we maintained. And some are sometimes a bit questionable.
Yeah. So I'm sure it's good enough for your analysis. I'm just wondering how much you discard because they are not annotated.
Yeah, I should look at that. I was not worried by that. It was not that it's so high. I mean, we use the Saliana genome. We have about 16,000 genes that have clearly define orthologs between the different species. And in Saliana, most of the genes have been mapped. I mean, we know they're a transcription level, it's one of the best annotated plant species.
Are there any plant-specific pathways and the pathway databases like KEK, ReactOM, which you can actually look at enrichment in those of the pathways, not the core?
Yeah, that doesn't yield anything really, really interesting. So there's another one that's called ARA-seq that we use as well. So for ARA-seq, we confirmed the lipid enrichment. So it didn't bring a lot more than what we had with the GO categories. And I think a lot of these pathways miss the regulators of the pathway. They have the enzymes, the biosynthetic enzymes, but not always the regulators. And so maybe that's why we don't see so much. I don't know. Okay. So this I'm going to cut short. But for proline, actually, we find that there's an enrichment among ancestral cis-acting changes. And that would suggest that, as I said, what we call ancestral could be also derived in the Saliana lineage. So it could be that proline synthesis became so important for stress resistance in the Saliana lineage. And it's a recent evolution along the Saliana lineage. So it has nothing to do with the divergence between the species. The thing that was funny is that we found that there's an enrichment among proline-related genes among the genes that show an allele-specific change that down-regulates the gene in the Lorata lineage. So maybe it's relaxed constraint and the function has been further lost. But it's not so simple because it doesn't always mean that you down-regulate a gene. It might have something to do with how you accumulate it. And so I don't really know. What we do have is we have metabolite measurement that confirm that proline is at the lower level in Lorata and Halorai compared to Saliana. Okay, so this is my last. Okay. So I think this approach is nice because we get novel hypotheses that we can test. We validate things that are known as well. I think it's also interesting because it is complementary to existing approaches, like genome scans will sort of tend to detect things that were subjected to RAD sweeps. GWAS will detect all the genes that are important for large effects on different phenotypes. And so in our relative rate test of cis-regulatory evolution, we would probably pick the genes that have small effect but accumulate and collectively do something, but also maybe the mutations that are involved in surf sweeps, and also all the mutations that are not fixed. So all the standing variation that might be important actually for adaptation, but that we cannot tell from the frequency. So I think that's quite good. The advantage is also that it can be implemented in non-model species. I should modulate this a little bit because it depends on the annotation and the quality of annotation. Yes. And what I think is really interesting is that it can be explored in ecologically relevant conditions, so plants can be subjected to growth conditions that reflect their ecology. But we need to shift from towards the collective properties. And so once we have a phenotype, afterwards we can look at the phenotype that is predicted. But reconstructing exactly what change did what, probably it's a mixture of changes in the protein activity itself and cis regulation. We heard this from Eugene last week. The limitation is that it's quite dependent on the quality of the functional annotations, and it doesn't have to do with really how close you are to a model species. It really has to do with how function is being described in databases. And so I think this can be improved. The other thing is I think we lose a lot of information when we focus only on upregulating cis-acting changes. It would be good if we could also incorporate down-regulating cis-acting changes and have some sort of models that tell us, okay, when we have this combination of changes, what is the output on the phenotype?
But why can't you incorporate down-regulating changes right away from RNA-seq?
We see them. We've looked at them. But the thing is, I don't really know how to interpret them because I think this is what I said with proline. I mean, maybe you have just lots of mutations because the function is lost, and so you lose the expression of the genes that are actually very active in the species where the function is important, and then that's rather relaxed selection, and that's not really what I'm looking for. But yes, I can look at them, and I find categories in down.
But that could be even enhanced selection to down-regulate because there could be some negative or deleterious effects from the
gene. It could, but I can't really tell. This is what I think is that the data is going to be more noisy, mm-hmm. and so that's why I didn't focus on it. And I would privilege the ones that are enriched among upregulated genes for running afterwards downstream experiments. Okay.
So if you go back, take for example the chlorophyll biosynthesis.
Yeah.
If you look at all of the genes that have a GRO annotation that says they're in chlorophyll biosynthesis, what fraction of those actually show up as
I can't tell you just like that. I mean, that's what the enrichment is quantifying.
It's whether 100%, you're saying.
No. There's a mixture. No. And even in the ranking, I mean, some of them might be really on the top of the ranking and some of them are not on the top of it. I mean, it's. Yeah. So, what I think we have to think about, this is really a statistical analysis of this of the molecular function. But it's not because you have a change that is this function important. You can't tell the one-to-one correspondence. It's just that it gives you a good candidate phenotype, molecular, in this case, it's a biochemical phenotype to look at now.
Done with the this part. So if you didn't make the hybrids, but simply took the three transcriptomes and did some sort of ranking of transcript abundance, could you have arrived at the same conclusion? In other words, would you have seen these same changes in, say, expression ranking?
Well, I don't think I would have had. So I haven't done it, so I can't really compare it. I think it could still pop up. But then I wouldn't know what is the genetic basis of these changes. If I have just a transcription factor that changed things, like this is what people did for heavy metal genes. They've seen that the genes are more highly expressed in Halorhizan than in Thaliana. Right. But they didn't know whether it was one major regulator that changed this, whether it was a lot of independent cis-acting mutations that would accumulate. And because we find that it's an accumulation of cis-acting mutations that we don't find in the other hybrid, this tells us that there is this is the signature of polygenic selection. So I'm not saying that we could find genes that are differentially expressed when we compare the species, but we could not easily infer what's the action of natural selection.
Okay, and then my other comment when you're showing your networks, I thought you were going to actually map these onto like transcriptional networks, which seems like it could be a really powerful way to proceed before playing around with the go codes, because there's such good network data for rapid access.
I'm not sure they're that good.
Well, there's lots of co-expression data, right? So you could use
the co-expression data are included in the Go annotations, actually.
How so?
Well, this is experimental based computational annotation where people are trying to look at genes that are co-expressed, and some of the genes that we find actually to belong to the same Go categories, and we can't always tell why they're together, is because they are co-expressed. But so we could run exactly the same thing for, as you were mentioning, for specific pathways or for specific I'm trying to remember what we did for the co-expression networks. We looked at them, but they were not really so. Yeah. So okay. So I'm trying to recall what we've done. So we have clusters of co-expressed genes in Thaliana that we use, and we find some enrichment there, but we were not very good at interpreting what was the meaning of these enrichments, and the Go categories were easier to interpret. But I think part of it was a technical problem we had. Yeah.
The point of doing the, I think, mapping it onto the co-expression networks is not as the endpoint, but then that gives you a larger, it sort of gives you a potentially a functional cluster that you could then do the functional annotation on. So
So the problem for us was that the genes that you find co-expressed, we could not relate them to a biochemical or phenotypic of sort of a higher order phenotype that would be sort of inspiring. That's why we didn't go much further into this. But I think,
or in other words, they do not cluster in any visible categories. You cannot sort of cluster them.
Yeah. That was a bit our problem, but I mean, I confess that we haven't been as far as we could have gone there. I mean, we should probably work more on that. Acknowledge two postdocs who work on the project, Fehe and Agustin Asse, Gregor Schmitz, who's our experimental support, and the funding. All right. It's just the degree of divergence that they have. I mean, they can interbreed a little bit, but they don't interbreed very much in the field. They don't occur in the same populations, and when they do, there's a little bit of exchange, but not much. So that, for example, people have shown that one of these incompatibility genes has been introduced by selection into the neighboring species, but that's because the selection is very strong on those genes. So there is a little bit of exchange. So I think, in plants it's sort of a continuum usually, you know, and then at some point, you asked me about whether I could cross Lorata and Halawa. You can cross them. Some of them are viable and others are not, and it's sort of partial isolation already. Yeah.
Could you actually go back to this segregation? So ecologically, if they do grow in the same field, does one outgrow the other?
Actually, when I say sympatric populations, it's not really true. It's similar areas, so probably it's the pollinators that probably carry the pollen from one place to another. They grow in completely different environments. So Halawai is actually quite good at dealing with competition, and it actually needs the competition with other species to get sort of a protected atmosphere. And that's probably also why it is not very good at dealing with abrupt changes in the environment, gets very stressed and kicked out of balance. Lorata is not a very good competitor. It grows in areas that are much more exposed to drought and to changes in temperature. And so, no, they don't really co-occur and they don't really compete directly against each other.
Any questions?
Okay, so let's